Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thank you very much for listening on Friday, November 21st, 2014. It is the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week. Every week, we ask two experts in the world of the federal government to make their choices for the three most important federal news stories of the week. They rank them in order from least important to most important. They send them in, and they come in and count them down on the Federal News Countdown. This week, my experts on the Federal News Countdown are colleagues and fellow broadcasters. It's Gigi Shum and Aileen Black. They are partners in Accelerated Government Strategies, and they are the hosts of Women of Washington on Federal News Radio. Ladies, the program's terrific, first of all. Thank you for being on the countdown today. I love the show, and I want you to tell everybody when it's on, when they can hear it, and, of course, they're archived on federalnewsradio.com. Aileen, when is the program on the air?
The program airs or premieres on Wednesdays at 9 a.m., and
Excellent.
Then it plays again on at 10 a.m. on Fridays and again on Monday at 2 p.m. And, of course, they're available online at federalnewsradio.com.
We play it a lot because it's good, and it debuts Wednesday right after the Federal Drive, right after Tom's show. And they're always archived on the website. And, of course, we refer to Women of Washington around the studio here as WOW, because for obvious reasons. And it made me laugh to learn that you guys do the same thing. So great minds think alike, Gigi.
That's right. That's right. We think it's a wow, Francis.
It is a wow. And I appreciate you both being on today. You've made great selections for the countdown. And we will start where we always do with...
Number three!
Aileen, your choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. The headline is VA Fails Cybersecurity Audit for 16th Consecutive Year. There's a silver lining here, I guess. It's a small one. And the silver lining seems to be that they're making progress. It sounds like a GAO report, you know, progress being made, but more work to be done. But because this is the 16th year in a row they haven't hit FISMA marks, that seemed to be the bulk of where the news coverage was. Am I right?
That is correct, Francis. And again, I want to thank you for having us on the show today. Instead of taking my punches at VA, mm-hmm. when I read this article, I can tell you the very first thing I thought of is, boy, these type of cyber breaches are very costly and very dangerous to everyone. I mean, even there was an article that came out late last night from the Wall Street Journal that basically was talked about how NSA talked about the fact that we could have some dramatic cyber attacks mm-hmm. where we could lose our power on the entire East Coast, for an example. So, you know, these breaches happen every day. There was at least three or four this week alone, State Department, Postal Service. I mean, there's several that have occurred. And, you know, when you start seeing agencies fail something for the 16th time, you got to wonder, are we going to hold them accountable? But on the other hand, when you stop and you think about it, you have to empower these agencies to be able to do the right things, to be held accountable. And let's face it, Francis, these types of security issues is like an arms race. Mm-hmm. And every single day, somebody's figuring out new ways to find out something new to combat what you just fixed.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a very difficult time. It's, you know, let's face it, our federal procurement and some of our decision processes out there have been calcified, and it's difficult for these very good people in these public positions in the federal agencies to get their job done with limited budgets and limited personnel and the difficulty with the procurement. So, you know, we have to arm them. Mm-hmm. And when I look at something like this, first I got upset 16 times. The second thing I said was, well, wait a minute, are they in a position to really get things done? So, you know, I really think that we need to start looking at new ways. You know, I heard on your show a couple of weeks ago, you talked about 18F. You know, we have the White House fellows. We need to find new ways to not only empower them and arm them, but also to bring in new ways and new products and capabilities to be able to combat this arms race that we're dealing in cyber.
VA has an effort underway already to do just that. Marina Martin is leading their digital services effort. I talked to her recently at the Executive Leadership Conference in Williamsburg, and she wants to do the same kinds of thing exclusively for VA that 18F and the U.S. Digital Services will do for agencies across government. That is going to be a liaison between the companies and organizations that can offer that kind of innovative technology and the VA kind of matching up one with the other, and both ways, not just industry to agency, agency to industry, too.
that kind of innovation will help us combat these things. And she also sounds like a great guest for our show. So if you're listening, let us know. We'd love to have you on the show.
She would be a great guest for the show. This story says the inspector general told VA the agency has reduced its number of vulnerabilities by 21%. Steph Warren, the chief information officer at VA, says the agency's making plans to address the concerns from the upcoming audit report that the VAIG will put out. And we'll learn more about that later in the program. But that's kind of the silver lining that I was alluding to earlier. VA certainly aware of these problems after 16 years. And the inspector general saying, well, 21% reduction in vulnerabilities is what the VA mentioned. And as an outside observer, I think that's a pretty fair chunk of change, of difference that they've made in the past year.
You know, I'm sure that the folks at VA wake up every day trying to figure out ways to do their job better and to be more effective at meeting these goals. You're exactly right. They've made a great deal of progress. You know, like I mentioned before, you know, cyber attacks and the way that malware gets inserted in there is definitely a arms race. Mm-hmm. But you can't stop them from being able to do their job. I mean, it's sort of like the only way you could is shut off the internet. And I don't think that's an option that, you know, the constituents that actually the veterans out there would find acceptable, because they couldn't get their services done if you can't access the internet. So it's that balance that you have to find between delivering your services, doing your job, and also protecting.
Aileen Black's third most important federal news story of the week is from The Washington Post. The headline, VA fails cybersecurity audit for 16th consecutive year. Gigi Shum, your third most important story of the week is from FedScoop. The headline is, CMS creates chief data officer position and new data office. CMS is not unique in this. There are other agencies that are doing this. The Commerce Department's moving in this direction, too. But is this something that you think we'll see more of, as the agencies are really good at collecting data? They're getting better at understanding what they have and being able to ask the questions to use it. But is it your sense that more will want a person or and a group of people under that person to be able to help them do that?
Absolutely. I think so, Francis. And thanks so much also for having me on as well. When I read this, and you're right, they're not the first. In fact, I think they're the third agency to appoint a chief data officer. And when I first read the story, I thought, you know, so to answer your question, I think, yeah, it's a trend, and I think we're going to see more of it. But my first reaction was, what the heck is a chief data officer anyway? And when I read into it, it really seems that it's around trying to provide better services to the citizens by making the data more transparent. So it certainly has a noble cause. I think it's definitely a worthwhile effort. But I think the thing that I wonder about is, what are the roles and responsibilities of a chief data officer vis-a-vis a chief privacy officer, vis-a-vis a chief security officer? You know, we're getting to see that, you know, we've got a lot of chiefs in these agencies, and I'm not sure that I understand a clear delineation of what each of them are responsible for.
I wonder if we'll see the evolution of this position, though, the same way we have seen and continue to see the evolution of some of the other technology chiefs, CIO and the CISO and so on. You can go agency to agency to agency, go to the CIO council, and nobody quite does exactly the same job at different agencies. The roles and responsibilities and the portfolios look different, sometimes dramatically different from agency to agency. I would imagine that we'll see the same thing with the chief data officer, do you think?
I think so. I absolutely think so. And I'm hopeful, right? As much as I'm a little bit skeptical about what the position is, I'm hopeful that that they do carve out a real meaningful job, and that the job has some real authority and accountability to it, because we all know that CMS has some of the most critical data in the government right now, with the Affordable Health Care Act and trying to provide those services to the citizens. And they have a long way to go to earn their credibility and to make that data more transparent. So I think there's all the promise in the world for it to be a really meaningful position. And it'll be really interesting to see what direction they take it.
It's pretty obvious that not just CMS and not just the other agencies that have done it so far. You're right. This story references the other agencies that have appointed CDOs. But even the agencies that aren't there yet are at least serious about how they're presenting data to the general public and to anybody that wants to use it. And so it's obvious they're taking seriously the mandate from OMB to do just that. They're not just doing it because, I guess we have to because OMB's telling us to. They're really embracing this and understand the power of it.
Absolutely. And I think one of the benefits that any organization, whether it be a federal agency or private sector, one of the real benefits that you get from elevating a position like that to the C-level is that it has the potential to really be a part of the executive team and really in on all of the important decisions. And so it may be a little bit of marketing and perception that they're creating this position, but I really do think it should help them internally add some extra weight and some extra importance to the role of data and making sure that they are making that data available.
The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Gigi Shum, is CMS creates chief data officer position and new data office. It's from FedScoop, and you can read it and all of the stories on this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Gigi Shum and Aileen Black on the Federal News Countdown on Federal News Radio. This is In Depth with Frances Rose on Federal News Radio. It is the WOW edition of the Federal News Countdown. The Women of Washington hosts, Gigi Shum and Aileen Black, are choosing the three most important federal news stories of the week, and we are up to
number two.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Aileen Black. It's from federalnewsradio.com. It's Jason Miller's story headlined, NGA's Belief in Open Source and Crowdsourcing Heating Up. And I imagine there were a number of folks, Aileen, that were surprised to see the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, of all agencies, talking about open source and talking about crowdsourcing. What did you see when you read this that caused this to jump out at you?
Well, a lot of times people focus on the negative of things.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a real positive highlight, and so that's why it had some meaning to me. It highlights an agency and its employees finding innovative ways with limited budget, and in this case, with limited ability to be open, to get their job done and to take on new missions. And so my hats are off to Dave White, the CIO at NGA, and Chris Rasmussen, who's NGA's public software development lead, and all the rest of the folks there at NGA, because this couldn't have been an easy thing to do, but this type of innovation will really help save money. And, you know, Frances, I don't know if most people out there who's listening right now understand what crowdsourcing is,
mm-hmm.
and what open source can mean. Open source is obviously, is something that is out there and people can leverage and use without having to have ownership or pay. It's open and available. And crowdsourcing to me is, cloud computing allows that elastic, ability to be able to get pools of resources. Crowdsourcing does the same thing for people.
Mm-hmm.
It allows you to get a group of people to share and help do development. So what NGA has done is they're leveraging a crowdsourcing or a platform or a portal called GitHub, and there's other products out there that are available, Bitbucket, and there's numerous, that allows them to have input and get information and to get programming and code from people out there who have great ideas, which will help NGA with their mission and get it done effectively with very little budget. But NGA, the most amazing thing is that NGA is a classified part of the intelligence community. So
mm-hmm.
what they did was they put together a discipline, a process and procedure to leverage this, but still protect the agency's mission. And so, again, I just my hat's off to that kind of innovation. It's great to see agencies doing that. It looks like some other agencies are. And I just wanted to mention it.
Gigi, what message does this send to the rest of the federal community when an agency that is as sensitive as they should be to matters of confidentiality and security and so on as NGA goes this direction? I would think that would be a tremendous endorsement for other agencies that are maybe on the edge or maybe even hadn't considered doing something like this.
I think so. You know, one of the things that we are always looking for federal agencies is to try to be innovative. And too often it's easy to fall back to the position to say, oh, we can't because, right? We can't because we have classified data or sensitive data. And the nice thing about what NGA has done is they know that they've got data that needs protecting, but not every single bit of data in an organization is that top secret sensitive data that, you know, classified, that cannot be, cannot be used out there, right? So I think as long as agencies approach this in a smart way, and they understand what they're trying to accomplish, what really is that sensitive data and what's not, they can then take advantage of things like open source, crowdsourcing, the cloud. And it I agree. I applaud them. They're really being innovative. And if they can do it, every other single agency should be able to find some part of their infrastructure and their applications that they could benefit from using open source or crowdsourcing or other innovative technologies.
That idea of saying yes instead of saying no is a concept I hear, too, from every single CIO that I talk to. We've got to get out of the mode. They all say it different ways, but we've got to get out of the mode of figuring out reasons to say you can't do something and figure out ways to start saying you can do something. And there's an if statement in many cases that goes along at the end of that, you can if. But at least they're figuring out ways that you can. And so this is I think, a neat way of going about that. What are some other ways that we might expect to see agencies or organizations inside agencies using GitHub or using open source community or crowdsourcing or any of these other kinds of things? Are there natural fits, do you think, that you might say, well, that's a great way to go about solving whatever the issue is. Aileen?
I think we should think about it beyond just individual agencies, but across the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's several applications or types of applications that are out there that everybody uses, payroll, HR. And some of them are COTS, some of them commercial off the shelf, and some of them are custom made.
Mm-hmm.
But if we were looking at how the government works as an enterprise and be able to use that platform to help develop and share, think of how much more effective and cost effective that would be instead of having these stovepipes, not only within agencies, but across the government, that and those barriers can come down and the government can act as an enterprise. Now, obviously, I'm talking about, you know, the ultimate goal, and I realize there's several reasons doesn't.
Yeah.
But we should work towards that because that's really the power of things like cloud computing, that ability to be able to expand those elastic pools of resources. And we need to think beyond just our own agency, beyond just the way that we program, but the way that we work with it and leverage it so that it can absolutely be just a utility like you get, your electricity from the plugs in the wall.
You sound like Dan Tangerlini. He was at the NAPA annual meeting a week or a week and a half ago and talking about that very idea that he's gone to these agencies and he's looked at their financial management systems and various things. And they all say, yeah, well, we have to do ours to our this custom way because of this. And he said they all think that they're special and they're all very special, but what they do is not that different in some of these more common applications. And that's really at the heart of where GSA and OMB are trying to go on shared services.
Think of the money that we would save if they did that. Now they probably do have some special parts, but 80%, 90% of it probably is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can get into the mode where we're looking at ways of more effectively leveraging each other's work and then extending it to meet our specifics, I think every taxpayer out there would appreciate it.
Aileen Black's second most important federal news story of the week is Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com, NGA's belief in open source and crowdsourcing heating up. Gigi, we're back with the VA. Your choice at number two is Jason's story on federalnewsradio.com, VA to spend $60 million more on cyber after auditors' continued concerns. We talked about the VA cybersecurity issues earlier in the program. I guess the question I took away from Jason's report when he put it out on this program earlier this week was $60 million is great. It's nice that they have the resources to be able to do it, but what do you get for your $60 million? And I'm not questioning what Steph Warren's plan is at the VA, but I wonder if that's a question that we can expect him to be asked by, say, Jeff Miller, the chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. Great. What are you going to do with the $60 million? Is that enough or is it too much for what you really need to accomplish?
Absolutely. And I think they are getting asked that question. I think, you know what, Francis, I'm going to be a little bit tougher on VA than you and Aileen were. You know, I think when you fail your FISMA audit 16 times in a row, there's a right for everybody to be concerned, as I'm sure that VA is. But I understand why GAO is really dissatisfied with some of the progress that they've made. And I understand why they're getting asked the really tough questions up on the Hill, because, frankly, a lot of the things that have been uncovered year after year in these audits have not been remediated. So I think you ask a great question. Is it $60 million or $6 million or $600 million? One of the things that we know when we talk about cyber is that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Mm-hmm.
And Aileen referenced the three or four different agencies that have been hacked just this week. And you know, VA has certainly had their share of attacks. And it's time that they really do get the basics taken care of. And it's some of it's technology issues, but frankly, Francis, some of it is policy issues. Mm-hmm. There's a statement in Jason's story, and I think he did a great job on this, by the way. It's that the SOC, the NSOC at VA, doesn't have visibility to all of the systems that they're supposed to be monitoring. Well, that's a policy issue, as it turns out, not a technology issue. How is that SOC? I mean, I'm sure that the well-meaning people who get up every day trying to do the right thing, but how is that SOC supposed to be effective in identifying and preventing hacks
mm-hmm.
if they don't even have visibility to them? You
That's
can't
right.
stop what you can't see.
The most disturbing thing in this story to some of the folks that I talked to this week are the issues that don't seem to get solved or addressed year after year after year, Aileen. Here's one passage from Jason's story. Greg Wilshusen of the Government Accountability Office said about that NSOC, about the visibility, couldn't ensure an attack was contained and stopped. And Sandra McCauley, the Deputy Assistant IG for Audits and Evaluations at VA, said auditors were very worried about the large number of vulnerabilities at data centers more than 5 years old. Now, the ongoing nature of some of these problems that continue to show up, and we gave the VA credit earlier in the program, and I think they deserve that credit, for reducing the number of issues by 21%, and I think that's fair to give them credit for that. But boy, there's still a big chunk of stuff they still have on their plates.
Well, as I stated in the beginning of when I talked about this, at first I was angry mm-hmm. 16 times. I mean, the definition of insanity is continuing to do the same thing and expecting different results.
Yeah.
And so the first thing you need to look at is the policy, procedure, and discipline, as Gigi has pointed out, and to make sure that they have the proper tools to actually make those changes. But, you know, the stakes are getting too high now, Francis.
Mm-hmm.
Cybersecurity breaches are costing us dearly. And eventually, you know, potentially, we could have a digital 9/11. And we've got to start addressing this and holding the people accountable, giving them the tools and the funding to be able to get it done. Don't get me wrong. But this, you can't have a 17th time. I mean, I'm not giving them 6 cents. If I don't think there's going to be, if it was up to me, which it isn't.
Well, but you can understand why an overseer would say, I'm not giving you, whoever is there,
that's
in
right.
this case, it's Steph Warren, I'm not giving you and your team money to do it for the 17th year in a row. I'm going to give it, we can release these funds when there's somebody else doing the job. I mean, that doesn't strike me as an unreasonable request. Yes, there's pressure on that chief information officer. Well, welcome to the world, I suppose.
Yeah, it's pressure in the public, in the commercial sector too. Except when, you know, Target lost that information,
mm-hmm.
they were held accountable, and there are financial repercussions for that occurring. Now, you know, the breaches for maybe the VA, the veterans out there, for their personal data, you know, there's going to be aftermath to that data being out there that can put them in harm's way. And again, I know the VA is a great organization. I know they take the seriousness of supporting our veterans out there, but we can't see number 17.
Yeah. One final thought on this regarding this data breach that Steph Warren addressed at this hearing. He talks about bringing in Mandiant to look at these domain controllers which is where the fall down was on this data breach. And Jason writes, Warren said VA has been working to get Mandiant on board for about a year. Now, I asked Jason, is that short or long? Because it seems like a long time to me. And he didn't pass judgment on that. But you guys have done this for a living. You've been on the other ends of those calls where agencies say, help, we need you 10 minutes ago because this is an emergency. Is that a long time, long turnaround time?
I think it is, Francis. And, you know, I don't know the specifics of why it took VA a year to get Mandiant in, but you hear all the time about the need for acquisition reform.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of it is that it takes way too long for these agencies to try to get anything done, even when the organization is on fire, mm-hmm. right? And that's usually when Mandiant gets called in, is when something is wrong and they come in and try to do the forensics and figure out what's happened and you know, what was stolen and how they got in, and then how the organization can remediate. And they can be most effective if they get in right after the breach, right? It's like mm-hmm. anything else. It's like if you're a police department and you're investigating a crime,
yep.
and the crime is now a year old.
That's right.
Right? You're following a lot of dead ends. So it's the same kind of situation. And I don't know why it took a year to get them in, but I would bet that it had something to do with the acquisition process and all of the hoops that they needed to jump through to try to get a contract to Mandiant.
Aileen, that makes sense to you?
It does. When you have a cyber breach, there are some caveats that will allow an organization to sort of jumpstart the procurement and contracting process. Mm-hmm. But let's say this particular situation didn't fall within the realm. First off, you need to educate folks like that about how to leverage and what tools they have. And then we need to take a look at how we can provide them with the mechanism to get it done. Did they have the funding? Did they have the contract mechanisms? In the sales teams I've always managed, the very first thing I teach them is the hardest thing sometimes isn't to provide, you know, the solution that you have to meet the customer's needs. They're excited about it. They're on the other side of the desk. They want to do what they need to do to get their job done. But sometimes there's obstacles in their way that just doesn't let the apertures open up. Mm-hmm. So before you go in there, think through that. Is there procurement and contracting mechanisms in place? Is there funding available? If those types of things are not in place for the tools for the people at VA to not make this be number 17 of a failure for cybersecurity, then we owe it to the veterans into the VA to make some changes.
Gigi Shum's choice for the second most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is VA to spend $60 million more on cyber after auditors' continued concerns. It's Jason Miller's report on federalnewsradio.com. It and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown are archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week on the Federal News Countdown. Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by the hosts of the Federal News Radio program, Women of Washington, Aileen Black and Gigi Shum, the founding partners of Accelerated Government Strategies. And the program we mentioned earlier in the show, the program, the first run is always on Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock, right after the Federal Drive with Tom Temin. And then it runs a couple of other times throughout the week, and it's on archived at federalnewsradio.com, and I commend it to anybody who hasn't heard it yet. We are up to, on this week's Federal News Countdown, come on, guys.
Number one. There we go.
They're striking this week, I think. The most important federal news story of the week is selected by you. Gigi is from the Washington Post. The headline is Republican leaders hope to contain outrage in the ranks over Obama immigration moves. And Aileen, your choice at number one is from GovExec. The headline is Republicans see an upside to a government shutdown over immigration. The reason this is so consuming for people is that whole shutdown idea, I think. And we've seen Speaker Boehner, and we've seen the incoming majority leader, Senator McConnell, saying as many times as they possibly could after November 4th, there's not going to be a shutdown, there's not going to be a shutdown, there's not going to be a shutdown. And yet we continue to hear very faintly, not very loudly. And my sense from the folks that I talk to on the Hill is that it becomes more and more faint, not more and more loud, thankfully. But it's still out there. It's still bubbling out there. And I wonder if we might get to a point where we continue to talk about it so much that it kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. That's my worry, is that people talk about it so much that eventually somebody goes, well, I guess it's just kind of inevitable because it's what we continue to hear about. Does that make sense, Aileen? Does that possibility?
Yeah, that is very much a possibility. And again, this article spoke to me not because I believed or my beliefs around immigration. It wasn't about my beliefs whether the president acted within his powers. It was really about that aftermath. That aftermath that can ensue based on, you know, the government, either sides of the aisle, not finding common ground and accepting not having progress. I believe this Congress, 113th Congress, has been the least productive in decades. And if the appropriation bill goes in front of the Senate and it has any language added on that, you know, changes the funding or has anything that addresses immigration control within it, my challenge is it's going to become a standoff.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, the aftermath is going to be, 800,000, government employees not going to work. And it's not just those employees, it's the other people that are affected. It's the cafeteria workers that aren't going to go there to serve lunch. And all these families that are basically going to be without income right around Christmas. And it just really concerns me. It's just not an acceptable situation in general.
I would call your attention, ladies, to this headline from Roll Call this afternoon. GOP still fuzzy on strategy to block Obama's immigration move. And the synopsis of that story is they want to do something. They want to try to stymie it somehow, Gigi, but they're just not sure how to do it. And my takeaway after reading, listening to the speech and then reading the transcript of the speech and then some analysis from people who are a lot smarter about the legal ramifications here than I am is maybe part of the reason they're not sure about what their strategy is because they don't have a whole lot of openings. The president didn't go nearly as far policy-wise as some people thought that he would. It strikes me from having watched this as far as how CBP and ICE deal with these issues, what he said was more a codification of what the administration's policy has been for the last several years than an actual dramatic change in policy that they're going to their policy is going to be to look for lawbreakers and deport them and not just deport anybody that they round up. So I'm not sure that's really that much of a thing. I mean, he didn't add anybody to the Affordable Care Act. They're not eligible for health care benefits or anything like that. I'm not sure I see the opening for them to really be able to, I'm using air quotes, do something.
Right. So, Francis, I agree with you. But here's the thing. I think that the Republicans on the Hill are upset not so much about what was done and the policy itself that's in the executive order, but rather the way that it was done. And, of course, it's been the most divisive administration and the most divisive Congress in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just mentioned that in Roll Call, they talked about this frustration over trying to figure out what their strategy is going to be. And they're fuzzy right now because the truth of it is they don't really have a whole lot that they can do. And I think that's why I chose this as the number one story of the week, because it's my fear that frustration is going to make that what has been that soft noise about a potential government shutdown get a lot louder.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they don't choose that, what I consider kind of the nuclear option, which is a government shutdown again, I do think it's likely that we will see some ramification because the budget is really the only lever that they believe they have to show their displeasure and their frustration and their anger. And so I think it's likely that even if we don't see a government shutdown, we might see language riders on the back of the appropriations bills that will, adversely affect our agencies that are trying to get their missions accomplished. And more than anything, I think it's that atmosphere of uncertainty about what may happen that's going to cause a lot of government agencies to spend a lot of time trying to figure out what may come and how are they going to impact. Remember when we had the shutdown, how much time was absolutely wasted mm-hmm. by agencies trying to figure out how they were going to handle that as opposed to actually carrying out their mission. And they get more frustrated than anybody by it, but it's work that needs to be done if you're facing that uncertainty.
We have to take a break, but when we come back, there's a wrinkle here that I think might be instructive to take a look at, and we'll do that when we continue on the Federal News Countdown. The most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Aileen Black and Gigi Shum, both on the government shutdown possibility because of President Obama's immigration speech this week. On the Federal News Countdown, we'll continue in just a moment. Thanks for listening to In Depth with Frances Rose, this week's Federal News Countdown featuring the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Aileen Black and Gigi Shum, the hosts of Women of Washington on Federal News Radio. And both of you chose, as we discussed a moment ago, as your most important federal news stories of the week, stories about the congressional response to President Obama's speech on immigration this week. And I presented the possibility of a wrinkle that may be an out for the speaker. I don't think we have to worry about the Democratic Senate being able to do what they want to do as far as either whether it turns out to be an omnibus or a continuing resolution for the rest of fiscal 2015. The wrinkle that may make this workable on the House side is what's referred to as the Hastert rule. Speaker Boehner has continued this policy of only being willing to introduce legislation that a majority of the majority will pass. Now, that might sound like convoluted, but it really essentially means he only has to get 110 Republicans to vote for a bill in order for it to be brought to the floor in the first place. If he knows he can get 110 Republicans, then he'll do it. That means he's got to bring 109 Democrats along with it to get him. That would actually get him to 219. He only needs to be at 218 to get that bill to pass the House. I don't know of anybody that thinks that they're still, I think the number now with before the in the 113th Congress is at 220 some or 230 some Republicans on the House side. I don't think there's anybody that thinks that if he brought up a budget resolution with nothing in it about defunding whatever the president discussed this week, that he'd lose half his caucus. And so if he can keep half his caucus or more and bring along 100 or so Democrats, this can still work. So I'm not as pessimistic, Gigi, as some of the reporting has been on this. I could see a scenario where it could happen, but I can also see this kind of wrinkle allowing this maybe to go down to the wire, maybe to be uncomfortable like it's been the last couple of times that we've worked through this, but for this, in the end, to work out to the benefit of the agencies for some funding vehicle on December 11th. To be sure that they're going to keep the doors open until September 30th. Does all of that make sense?
It does, and I certainly hope you're right. The thing that I would ask you, though, is what do you think that Boehner is going to do to mollify those in his own party who are spitting mad about this situation, right? Your numbers make sense. Right. I think that the majority of people on both sides of the aisle would say we absolutely don't want another government shutdown. But what are they going to do? What levers are there available for them to really show how mad they are about this situation?
Well, there's two things that I can tell you that I'm hearing from the Hill. One of them that I'm hearing is on this particular issue of making sure the government stays open and there is no other shutdown, he doesn't care about them. He's willing to leave them behind because they tried to challenge him for his speakership a couple of years ago. And nobody else wanted the job. So as far as saying, well, if he doesn't do what we want him to, we'll throw him overboard. I'm not sure that he really considers that that he's too afraid of that. The other thing that I'm hearing from the Hill to your point is there will be plenty of opportunities to defund this, to deal with ACA and so on in the 114th Congress when they have an even bigger majority. And so I think the strategy that he will try to do is try to get to this 109 number by telling a lot of those people, fine, believe what you want to believe. Let's fight that when we can really fight it and then have a Senate that is inclined to vote with us instead of vote against us. Because everybody knows, including the people in the House that are really opposed to this, that no matter what they do, it's not going to get through Senator Reid's Senate in the 113th Congress. That's what I'm hearing from the Hill, Gigi.
Yeah, and I think that makes complete sense. And I think that's, frankly, the smartest thing that Boehner can do is just tell them, like, sit it out, wait another mm-hmm. few months, and we'll have, you know, both the House and the Senate, and then we can take a new look at all of these things.
The Federal News Countdown this week featuring the most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Gigi Shum and Aileen Black, and you each chose stories about President Obama's immigration speech and what it might mean vis-a-vis a government shutdown. And I want to remind people again, Wednesday morning, the day before Thanksgiving, will be the next edition of Women of Washington. Who's your guest this week? Do you know, Aileen? You remember off the top? You're doing so many of them. You have so many great guests. that we it's hard to keep track of them all.
That is, we have had 25 wonderful guests, but for the week of Wednesday before Thanksgiving, we're we're going to play the best of Wow.
Okay? I love that. The best of Wow.
So we are still going through the voting process as to who that will be. But this week we replayed Janet Hill. And Janet Hill is not only had a famous roommate in college, Hillary Clinton, but also is the mother of Grant Hill.
Excellent. Thank you very much for coming on, both of you ladies. A terrific Federal News Countdown. We should do this again. And you can hear the program, and you can hear Women of Washington archived on federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Countdown is off for the holiday next week, and we're back the first week of December on Federal News Radio.